88.5.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. As former commissioner at the FDA and dean of two of the nation's most prestigious medical schools, David Kessler seems the least likely to fall under the spell of junk food. But chocolate-covered pretzels once proved irresistible to him. Now, in a new book, he explains why many Americans cannot control their appetites and what we can do to eat right. His new book is titled The End of Overeating, and Dr. Kessler joins me in the studio. We will welcome you as well. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Dr. Kessler, what a pleasure to see you again.
It's wonderful, wonderful to be here, Diane.
And you look so well. I have seen you in a variety of health, shall we say.
I think it's fair to say I have suits in every size, and you have seen me over the years significantly bigger. I've been up and I've been down, and most importantly, I never understood what was going on.
So if there were a set, a dish filled with chocolate-covered pretzels here right now, what would you be doing?
I'd be thinking about those chocolate-covered pretzels. And as important as your questions are, and the audience, those chocolate-covered pretzels would capture my attention. I'd be thinking about it. And I never understood that mystery. Why is it so hard to resist? What is it about those chocolate-covered pretzels that make it so hard to resist? They're just an inanimate object.
And what is it that insists in your brain that if you just have one, you can stop?
The science. The journey for the last 7 years was to try to figure out what was driving the inability to resist. That's what I wanted to understand. Because I sat there and I listened to people, and I try to listen as a physician. I listened to people who said they eat when they're happy, they eat when they're sad, they eat when they're hungry, and they eat when they're not hungry. And they didn't understand why they were doing things that they didn't want to be doing, knowing that it wasn't good for them, but they did it anyway. People who were very successful in all other aspects of their lives. Why did food have such power? That was the question. So let me take you through the science. Let me give you a couple of different pieces of the puzzle, because I think we now understand the mystery, and it's not a question of willpower. For millions of Americans, their brains have literally been hijacked. Their brains are activated by sugar, fat, and salt. And once you get, once you see the food, once you're cued, that anticipation, the brain gets activated and it doesn't shut off in those of us who it's very hard to resist. Take a vanilla milkshake. What is it about the vanilla milkshake that drives consumption? Is it sugar? Is it fat? Is it flavor? Which do you think it is?
Sugar.
You're right. You got it right. But if you add fat to that, the vanilla milkshake is even more reinforcing. We will want it more. When you give sugar and fat in combinations. Mm. You make it multisensory. What we find is that the brain circuits, the dopamine circuits, get activated, and they don't, what scientists call, habituate. So each time that sugar and fat stimulates you, that dopamine gets elevated, and that grabs your attention. Let me give you three characteristics. We wanted to understand, I wanted to understand, why it was so hard to resist. So we asked people, do you have three characteristics? Now, certain people, when I raise these characteristics, will have no idea what I'm talking about. The first, is it hard to resist that food in front of you? Is there a perceived loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods? Second, is there a lack of satiation? Is there a lack of feeling full? Three, is there a preoccupation? Is there a thinking about those foods in between meals? Lack of control, lack of satiation, a preoccupation with foods. And that we found that about 50% of people who were obese, about 30% who were overweight, about 20% who were healthy weight. This isn't an eating disorder.
Right.
This is absolutely normal behavior.
Right.
But we found that a very significant percentage of the population, more if you're heavier, reported those three characteristics. But even if you're normal weight, a significant percentage of people reported those characteristics. And if you extrapolate, there's always risks of extrapolation, that comes to some 70 million people who self-report this lack of control, this lack of satiation, this preoccupation with food. And then we studied those individuals. Now, the power of food comes from what? Does it come from the taste, of course? But it's not just the taste. It's the anticipation of food.
So yesterday, I was sitting at my desk, and I knew that there were chocolate-covered peanut M&Ms in Jonathan Smith's drawer.
That describes the power of food.
Exactly.
That anticipation. Now, what was it? Was it your desk? Was it the location? With such effective learners, you had remembered about those peanuts in that drawer. When every time I land at San Francisco Airport, I start thinking about these Chinese dumplings. As soon as the plane lands on the taxiway,
you're thinking about them.
Because at the food court at the airport.
And you can smell everything.
The anticipation of food. If I can just make it to baggage claim, I can distract myself, right? But it's the power of food to condition our behavior. And it's not only conditioned behavior, it's conditioned and driven behavior. And I'll explain that in a minute. But if you take people who have this loss of control, lack of satiation, a preoccupation with food, and if you put them in the brain scanners and you cue them, you give them a cue, the sight, the smell, the location, some anticipation, the brain activates.
Huh.
And in people who have a hard time resisting, there's greater activation of the brain. But what's most fascinating and most important, as soon as they start consuming the food, in people who don't have this, the brain activation shuts off. But in these individuals, the amygdala region of the brain continues to stay activated and doesn't shut off until all the food is gone. So what's going on is, for millions of Americans, the reason they have such a hard time controlling their eating is because sugar, fat, and salt are excessively activating the brain circuits, and no one explained it to them. It's not a question of willpower. We're constantly being bombarded with cues.
Television.
Sugar, fat,
television.
Salt.
Television ads.
On every corner, walk down, you'll see sugar, fat, and salt being sold. I have this cartoon in my head. Imagine this food court with the names of the different places on top of the each booth. And the way I see it now is one is selling sugar and fat. One should be named fat and salt. One should be fat, sugar, and salt. Because fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt, they stimulate, they activate. I had always thought I was eating for nutrition, for satiation, to feel full. Now I understand that I'm eating for stimulation.
Dr. David Kessler, he is former head of the FDA under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He served as dean of the medical schools at Yale University and the University of California, San Francisco. His new book, with a luscious-looking carrot cake at the top and carrots themselves at the bottom, is titled The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Quite a book, Dr. Kessler. Quite a book. Before we go on with this, I want you to tell us how the book and its idea came from watching Oprah.
One night, I'm surfing the channels, and I'm watching the Oprah Winfrey show, and there was a woman who was on the show, very well-dressed, very well-educated, very successful, and she started talking about her eating. And she said, I eat when my husband leaves for work in the morning. I eat before he comes home at night. I eat when I'm happy. I eat when I'm sad. I eat when I'm hungry, and I eat when I'm not hungry. The tears came to her eyes, and she said, I don't like myself. I wanted to listen as a physician and understand what was driving her behavior.
And we'll take just a short break. Right back.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11.
Coming up Monday on The Kojo Namdi Show, the new battleground in the work-life balance debate. A Labor Day look at what men find when they ask employers for family-friendly benefits. Plus, reimagining Washington 40 years from now. City planners and public officials lay the groundwork for development, traffic, and public life in 2050. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2, Monday, on WAMU 88.5.
Hello, I'm Koki Roberts from NPR News. We've seen a lot of changes in America's political landscape over the last 30 years, and through it all, Diane Rehm has been here to help you understand the latest developments. Through 6 presidential administrations, 15 midterm elections, and even an impeachment, we've relied on the Diane Rehm Show for civil conversations that enlighten, engage, and connect. Happy 30th anniversary, Diane. Here's to many more.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And if you've just joined us, former FDA Commissioner David Kessler is with me. We're talking about his new book titled The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Now, Dr. Kessler, on the cover of this book, as I said, is an absolutely luscious-looking piece of carrot cake with the cream cheese icing, and below are 3 very simple looking carrots. Now, which is more appealing?
Which grabs your attention?
Well, of course.
Which is it?
The carrot cake.
If you understand that cover, you understand the neurobiology of overeating and why we have such a hard time. We are all wired as human beings to focus on the most salient stimuli in our environment. If you have a family member who's home sick right now, that's the most salient thing. It's top of the mind. It captures you. And we all get captured by some stimuli in our environment. When you look at that cover, it's the carrot cake that captures your attention.
Of course.
For some of us, it might be alcohol. For some, it might be gambling. It could be tobacco. But for many of us, it's food. And the fact is, you may say, I just look at that because that looks good. But that activates your brain circuit. And that's an example of conditioned and driven behavior.
So if I am watching a television program and a commercial comes on for a luscious sandwich filled with beef and melted cheese and all the rest of it, if you had hooked up something to my brain, would you see a reaction in my brain?
Absolutely. If you're sensitive to that stimulus, let me explain the cycle of consumption, because it is that cycle of consumption and that activation of the brain that once you we understand what's going on with us, we can then try to fight back and prevent ourselves from being constantly stimulated. You see that ad on TV. You walk by your favorite place on the corner. You just get in the car, right? Or you're sitting at your desk the other day, and that thought of those what?
Chocolate-covered peanuts made by M&Ms.
That's a cue. For you, it was that past memory, that location, just sitting at your desk. You may have not even consciously remembered that those M&Ms were there, but that thought came into your mind. That's a cue. That captures your attention. That locks into your brain. There's this subtle arousal. You're in the cycle of cue, attention, arousal. Now, how do you get it out of your working memory, out of your brain? You go.
I walk over to Jonathan's desk and I say, may I have the M&Ms?
And the next time you're there, and you know that, you're going to do it again the next time you're cued. Because every time you engage in that behavior, you only strengthen the neural circuits to do it again.
Interesting.
But why is it so hard? It's not just conditioned behavior. It's not just learned. It's also driven. If I said to you, as you're sitting at your desk, you're thinking about, right, that food, you want that. And I say, Diane, or you say in your own head, right? You know this inner dialogue?
Right.
Boy, they would taste great.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't have them.
Right.
I really want them.
Right.
Maybe not now. But that only amplifies. That only increases the reward value. And that's the basis of obsessions and cravings. So once you're in this cycle, once you're stimulated, once you're cued, once you engage and allow yourself to strengthen those neural circuits, once you're bombarded with these cues and keep on repeating the behavior becomes self-sustaining. And you look at what's happening. The public health consequences are enormous. Why don't diets work? Diets don't work. You know, of course, they'll work for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. Right? That you can do. But if you have the old circuitry, if you have that old learning, right, you can lose the weight for a period of time, you know, sheer willpower, right? And just force yourself, you know, to resist. But then you go back in your environment. That old circuitry is still there. That old learning is still there. You then get cued again and stimulated again. What do you expect to happen? If there's no new learning, if there's no new circuitry, of course you're going to gain back the weight.
So what did you do to change your brain circuitry?
You can never get rid of the old circuitry entirely. It's always there. The only thing you can do is to lay down new learning, new circuitry on top of that old circuitry. It's not the stuff of sound bites. It's not the stuff of instant fixes or magic bullets. It's new learning. Now, there, you have to first understand that you're constantly being stimulated. You're being stimulated unconsciously. My hand will reach out for those chocolate-covered pretzels before my brain is even engaged. So once you understand that we're being stimulated, being bombarded, how do you protect yourself? Now, I can get rid of the cues. Take that breadbasket away. Take those chocolate-covered pretzels off the table. I don't want to see that. How realistic is that in our current environment? The best way to cool down the stimulus, there really are two. One, if you have absolute rules. Now, this is counterintuitive. But if you say to yourself, I'm not going to have those French fries. I'm just not going to eat French fries because you put those French fries. Once I start, right, once I'm primed, my brain gets activated and it doesn't stop. So absolute rules work. Once you have any ambiguity, boy, they would taste great.
Right.
You allow yourself that ambivalence of thought. They'd be great. No, I shouldn't have it. That's only going to make the power of reward greater. So absolute rules work. But the best thing, you have to change your relationship with food. Look at how we succeeded with tobacco. We didn't change the product. Product is the same. Very much in favor of regulation and legislation, but we still, this year we'll finally get it. We haven't had that. How have we had the successes that we've had? In the past, tobacco, a very reinforcing substance. Let me explain how it works. You take nicotine. You add, which is moderately reinforcing, you add to that nicotine the smoke, the throat scratch, the cellophane crinkling of the pack, the color of the pack, the time of day that you smoked, the image of the cowboy and the sense that it was cool. And what did we end up with? We ended up with a significantly addictive product.
And you and I both went through that product.
Absolutely. I give you a package of sugar, and I say, go have a good time. You'll look at me and say, what are you talking about? I add to that fat. I add color. I add texture. I add temperature. I put it on every corner. I may add the emotional gloss of advertising. I say you can do it with your friends and have a good time. And the consequences? The public health consequences are enormous. We have to change our relationship with food. Tobacco, we used to look at and say, I want that. That'll make me feel better. That's cool. What did we do? We changed the perception. That's not my friend. That's my enemy.
So is taxing soda, which has now been proposed to pay for health care, as we began to tax cigarettes, is that going to work?
We need what psychologists call a critical perceptual shift. Now, tobacco was easy, right? You could live without tobacco. We need food. Food has to be enjoyable. It has to be pleasurable. But large amounts of food, sugar, fat, and salt layered and loaded into the food as the food industry is doing and constantly feeding us, right? We have to change our perception because that fat, sugar, and salt that we're being sold is just bombarding our brains. We have to get to the point where we look at that huge plate of fries and say, that's not my friend. We have to change our perception of what we want. We have to change with our relationship with food. I didn't get this. I went to a food coach in New York, and she didn't understand the neuroscience. She didn't understand what was going on in our brains, but she understood how to control eating. She asked me what I ate for dinner. I told her. I had an appetizer and I had some fish. She looked at me and said, do you understand you had the equivalent of two meals? You had 12 ounces of protein during that meal? And I looked at her. I was FDA commissioner. I'm a physician. And I have to admit, I'm not sure I knew how much 12 ounces of protein even was, right? I had 3 ounces, something about your fist, right? And I was just eating My food was just layered and loaded. It tasted great. I didn't understand my brain was stimulated. Now I look at that huge plate of fat on fat, on sugar on fat. Pick any appetizer in an American restaurant these days.
Caesar salad.
Caesar salad, okay. I mean, salads today.
Salad's good.
Right? I mean, sure. You think lettuce?
Right.
You think tomato?
Right.
Right? But what's on the salad? You have the fat. Sometimes there's the bacon bits, the croutons. The croutons themselves are just loaded with fat and fructose corn syrup.
And so, what you are saying is that the food manufacturers, makers know precisely what they're doing.
They know the inputs. They know it's sugar, fat, and salt. They know sugar, fat, and salt make food irresistible. They know how to design food. Take buffalo wings, right? What's in it? The fatty part of the chicken, it's fried sometimes in the manufacturing plant, refried in the restaurant. That red sauce, sugar and fat, that white creamy sauce, fat and salt. What do you end up with? Fat on fat, on fat, on sugar, on fat and salt. It stimulates our intake.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You, Dr. Kessler, are absolutely passionate about this because you're talking about our own body chemistry and the manner in which our brains, our whole bodies are reacting to these kinds of food substances.
It's what makes us humans. The fact that our brains get captured by salient stimuli. And what the food industry is doing is putting that those salient stimuli, that fat, sugar, and salt, on every corner, making it available 24/7, making it socially acceptable. We're living in a food carnival. We're constantly being bombarded with the cues that the food industry are sending. I didn't understand that. The public health consequences. A decade ago, there were 4 cases per 1,000 of type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, on the medical chart, I could just as well write obesity as synonymous with type 2 diabetes. Today, that's 9 cases per 1,000. We all want health care reform. We want universal coverage. We want full access for every American. We spent 5 years ago $7 billion on drugs for diabetes. Today we're spending $13 billion drugs. But most importantly, and I've had the struggle, I've never understood what was going on with me. I never understood the mystery. I gained the weight. I lost the weight. I gained the weight. I lost the weight. I went to med school. I was dean, you know, of medical schools. I was commissioner of FDA. I didn't understand that my brain was being stimulated and activated. And just because, look, the food industry has to change. No question about it. Government has a role for disclosure and education. But just because my brain's being stimulated doesn't mean I can't do something about it. We have to take control. We have to understand that if our brains are being stimulated, we have to prevent ourselves from being manipulated. We have to be able to fight back.
How did you finally become aware that you and your brain were operating in ways that were detrimental to your own health?
With my colleagues, we spent the last 7 years trying to put together all the science. Some of it was animal, some of it was epidemiological, some of it was human brain imaging. And in writing the book, it was very important for me to try to unlock this mystery. I think we finally understand why, for millions of us, we struggle so hard. And we can tell people, finally, it's not your fault.
But what can you tell them as to how they begin to put new layers of brain chemistry in there?
New learning. a change relationship with your food. It has to first start with behavioral change.
Small ones.
Absolutely. Why did the French never gain weight until recently? They ate highly palatable foods. It wasn't the red wine. They ate sugar and fat, but they had barriers around it. They never ate between meals. They would never walk down the street eating. They never snacked. What did we do in this country? We took down those barriers. If I'm sitting here eating in this studio, you won't even think anything of
Yes, I would.
Well, I know where I am, right? And I will be well behaved. But we can eat anywhere. Go to a business meeting. And we've made it socially acceptable. We've become, in some ways, the laboratory for the world. The rest of the world is looking at us and saying, we don't want to be like them.
And with very good reason, Dr. David Kessler, former FDA director, is with me, and his new book is titled The End of Overeating.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11.
This I believe.
A laboring man needs bread and butter and cash to pay the rent. But he would be a poor individual indeed if he were not able to furnish the vestibule of his mind and his soul with spiritual embellishments beyond the price of a union contract.
I'm Bob Edwards. Join me for the latest in our series of original This I Believe essays next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI.
And that's today at 2 on WAMU 88.5. And you can find complete schedules at WAMU.org.
This week on Interfaith Voices, we ask, does theology belong in the healthcare debate? Our regular news analyst explains why, for many religious groups, the answer is yes.
They see healthcare, along with the budget, war and peace, any number of things, as moral issues.
That's Sunday afternoon at 3 on Interfaith Voices.
Today at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
If you travel by car, truck, boat, RV, or even private airplane, and you're considering cutting back on your transportation costs, you can donate your vehicle to WAMU 88.5. By doing so, you're supporting the news, talk, and music programs you depend on. Call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org, and we'll take care of everything from picking up your vehicle to providing you the paperwork for your taxes. Thank you.
A beautiful day out there, mostly sunny skies today, a high in the mid-80s. Cloudy tonight, a low around 65. Mostly cloudy on Labor Day, just a slight chance of rain, with a high around 80. It's 74 degrees right now in Northwest Washington.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And as you can well imagine, Dr. Kessler, we have many, many phone callers and emailers. Here's an email I'm sure many people are wondering about. From Sandy, do you think 12-step groups, i.e., Overeaters Anonymous, are effective in dealing with this, quote, addiction to certain foods? Would you, first of all, classify this as addiction?
I wrote the entire book. I've studied addiction my whole life. The behavior is without doubt conditioned and driven. Sugar, fat, and salt affect the same brain circuits as alcohol, tobacco, and gambling. There are similarities. There are major similarities in that those brain circuits are activated. It's conditioned and driven. It's wanting. It drives wanting. You stimulate somebody. You activate those brain circuits. It's very hard. Don't get in between, you know, me and that plate of fries, right? When my brain is stimulated. So there are major similarities between those substances. But understand, it's inherent in what makes us human. I thought when I started this journey, it would take me into the world of physiology and endocrinology, bariatrics, nutrition. It's at the core of what makes us human. If you understand overeating, you understand many of our basic impulses, our intrusive thoughts, how things come into our minds, capture us, drive our behavior. It's in essence what makes us human. It's not a disease, but it's a very big struggle, and it was a mystery, and people didn't understand. I say to people, do you have a loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods? Do you have this lack of satiation? Do you have a preoccupation with food? And not everybody is going to relate to that. About 15% of the population would just as well take their food by pill. They're the ones who are probably the most interesting to study. But for the rest of us, you can see people nod. If you have this difficulty in resisting, if you have this struggle, you understand the power of food, the anticipation of food, and how the struggle takes over a good part of your thinking.
So if you are part of a group called Overeaters Anonymous, helping you to become aware of how that addiction works, is that a good place to be?
Absolutely. There are not magic bullets. You have to change your relationship with food. It's new learning. It's not going to happen overnight. I explain it in the book. It requires you to change your relationship with food, but it first requires you to understand what's driving you. It's new learning. Lay down on top of that old learning. We have to change, not only for us as individuals, but our social norms are also a critical part of how we react as individuals. And I didn't understand this. If it's socially acceptable to eat any time, if on every corner there's that sugar and fat being sold, if it's a food carnival, I'm going to obviously want to get on the rides. I'm going to get stimulated. If we start changing our social norms, where huge portions or fat, sugar, and salt on every corner loaded into our food, I mean, frying the food, double frying the food, laying on sugar, laying on fat and all these sauces, where that becomes unacceptable, then it will help us cool the stimulus as individuals.
All right. To Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Christopher. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
You're like the reason why I pledged to my local KRA station, so.
Thanks.
I just wanted to comment. Something that I've seen or noticed in my own behavior with food and specifically soda is that when I drink caffeinated drinks that have actual sugar in them versus caffeinated drinks that have high fructose corn syrup in them, I am more likely, or I seem more prone to getting caffeine headaches after a week of drinking, for example, a Dr. Pepper versus a week of drinking Mexican bottled Coke. I'm wondering if, I mean, they've noticed anything like that in the studies and research of our reactions and different combinations of food.
Dr. Kessler.
Understand the power of a drink such as a carbonated soda. What is it for many of us? Why do we do it as much as we do it? There's the sweetness. That's a key ingredient. But on top of that sweetness, there's the temperature. There's the carbonation. There's the mouth feel. You put all that together, and you end up with a multi-sensory stimuli that, yes, has mild pharmacological effect, the caffeine. You add that, the sweetener, and for many people, that becomes significantly reinforcing.
Mm. You've mentioned several times that we have to learn to change our relationship to food. And you've said that it's a layering process on top of the learning we've already had that's already implanted in our brains. Give me, because I know you go into this in great detail in the book, give me the first step on that changed relationship with food.
Once you understand that we're stimulated by fat, sugar, and salt, that we want fat, sugar, and salt, when we look at it, we get cued, our brains get activated. How do you change it? How do you change the power of something once I want something?
Right.
The fact is, if you make food not taste good, if it's not pleasurable, it's not going to work. What you have to learn to do is you have to want something more. You have to learn to want something more. Now, what are the ways that can happen? And for each of us, it's very personal, and we can do it different ways. Some people become vegetarians. Now, I'm not advocating that, but why does that help them? Well, if they're vegetarians, then they look at animal fats and they say, I don't want that. Some people want to focus on natural foods. They look at that and say, I want that. I don't want all this sugar, fat, and salt. I've gotten to the point where I'm the last food purist around. I am not a food purist. Yeah. But I look at a huge plate of food now, and I say, that's disgusting. A hamburger's fine. But when you add bacon and cheese, you take that 500 calories and you make it 1,000 or 1,500. So you have to substitute something you want more. It may be exercise.
You know what I have implanted in my own mind from the time I was 16? I have said to myself, I love clothes more than I love food.
For each of us, it's individual.
Something different.
And for some of us, right? Some of us, it'll be exercise. Now, you say to somebody who's 300, 400 pounds, go exercise. That's the cruelest thing, you know, in the world. But start somewhere. Just walk halfway around the block each day. Begin to do something that's helpful. Once you identify yourself as engaging in healthful behaviors, that will carry over to other behaviors. Maybe it's planting your own garden, your own vegetables, wanting those more than the sugar, fat, and salt. We need alternative rewards. That's the way our brains work.
All right, to Easton, Connecticut. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you for your show. I absolutely love it.
I'm so glad.
And Dr. Kessler, thank you for this book. This discussion is fascinating. My question is, what is the role of hormones? In other words, how do hormones interact with the sugar, fat, salt impact on brain circuits?
A number of factors can change the reward value of food. So, and some of these work, you know, are hormonally based. So once you have that old learning, and we have to be honest with the public, once you have that old learning, you never erase that. You can add new learning on top of that. But if you stress me, if I'm fatigued, if I get deprived, if I get hungry, that old circuitry through hormones, that's how stress works. There are stress hormones, right, that will increase the reward value of food. And it's okay. The thought that you will never fall off the wagon, that you'll never be stimulated, you'll never reach for that donut ever again, you know, is unlikely. And the problem is we hold ourselves up to these standards. We don't understand that that old circuitry, once it gets laid down, is always it. Yes, we can do something about it. Yes, we can fight back. The thing that concerns me most is children. Children the age of two traditionally compensated for their food. They ate more at one meal. By compensation, I mean if you give children more calories at one meal, they'll eat less in the rest of the day. You give those children sugar, fat, and salt, they're just 3, 4, 5. They lose the ability to compensate. Hmm. They eat constantly. Hmm. It's as if the reward circuits, this conditioned hyper-eating, takes over and overrides the body's normal homeostatic mechanisms.
And this caller wants to know exactly how to deal with that. Emily in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. I was just listening to you, doctor, say that once the old circuitry gets laid down, but how do we lay down healthy circuitry for our children? How do we give that gift to our children of healthy thinking about food? And really, doesn't the battle begin with children?
Absolutely. The caller is exactly on point, and as a pediatrician, that is key. We play, as adults, great role models. And I think we don't realize the extent that our eating behavior, what kids see us eating, is a first step. What we have in our house, how we use food. If you use food, right, to change behavior, to as a treat, as a reward, right, you're only strengthening those circuits for a lifetime. Because once you lay that circuitry down in that 2-3 year old, that's going to be there for 70 years.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So what you're saying, as far as these children are concerned, is to keep the food treats, the sweet, the fat, the salt, at an absolute minimum as these children grow.
You have to be careful that you don't put too great an emphasis on it, because if it's seen as something that they want but they can't have, it'll only increase the reward value. But what we have done is we've always had sugar, fat, and salt. My grandmother, you know, at dessert, but it was occasional. Now we've taken sugar, fat, and salt. We've layered it and loaded it into a food. We made it available for breakfast, 10 o'clock, noon, mid-afternoon. We're eating constantly.
And drinking sweet drinks as well.
It's fat and sugar, just in liquid form.
It's a big book, Dr. Kessler, with so much information for us to think about in terms of evaluating our relationship to food. And I wonder if that tax on soda becomes a first step.
The goal in writing the book was to help people with their own personal struggle. Government has a role to help educate. They have a role for disclosure. Sure, taxes worked in cigarettes. They help change a behavior. And there may be a role. Why are we subsidizing fat and sugar production in this country? Once you understand, once we have grasped the fact that fat, sugar, and salt are stimulating our behavior, we now have that science. For decades, the food industry said they're just giving consumers what they want. Now we know that they're producing foods that are excessively activating the brains of millions of Americans. 50 years ago, the tobacco industry, confronted with the science that smoking caused cancer, denied it and deceived the American public. What's the food industry going to do now that we have the science, now that we know what they're doing? They have a role, government has a role, and we as individuals have a role to protect ourselves.
David Kessler, his new book with Carrot Cake and Carrots on the front is titled The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Go have a carrot, Dr. Kessler. Thank you so much for being here.
It's wonderful to be with you, Diane.
Good to see you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
September is Hispanic Heritage Month. Several area organizations are working to serve this rapidly growing community.
The Latin American Youth Center offers social services, workforce training, and educational programs for low-income youth.
The center's Arts and Media House uses art as a tool for exploring community issues. The Latin American Youth Center also offers classes in photography, audio and video production, drawing, painting, and mixed media.
Mary's Center for Maternal and Child Care is a bilingual